Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my psychic and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy and my tie-dye friend, Nathan Lee Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hello, Windy.
Nathan, why are you my tie-dye friend?
Because that's my style, baby.
So, we got contacted by a company. I'm going to call them a company. It's a collaboration, a group of friends who set up a t-shirt business called Pleaties, and basically they offered us some free shirts, and you know, we don't get offered free stuff very often, and it was very exciting. So we are now the proud owners of Pleaties shirts. Nathan and I both went for tie-dye options, and they're really, really cool. I'm not sure if I've worked up yet to have the courage to wear it outside the house. I need to get there. Nathan, it's very much in your style, though.
Yeah, this is custom designed specifically for me. I have many already matching garments of this style and the appropriate, remaining costume in my wardrobe. As our good friend Dan pointed out, Daniel Platt, what did he say? Where's the quote? Finally a brand for the fashion conscious Spurs supporting psychedelic aficionado.
I mean, that's something they should put on the website because it's perfect. Basically what they've done is they've designed some alternative Spurs tops, because it's not that cool for a grown man or woman to wear a replica shirt. Plus, I mean, have you seen the home shirt this year? So they're really cool. They've got really unique designs. I've got one. In fact, I don't want to give it away. I think you need to go on the website and have a look. It's pleaties.com is the website, or instagram.com/pleaties. Have a look on Instagram because they've put some nice shots up on there. If you use the code extra20, you get 20% off. And also, we have a shirt to give away as well. So one listener is going to win a shirt. All you need to do is leave us a review on your podcast platform and email us at podcast@theextrainch.co.uk, and we'll select our favourite review to get a shirt. They're really cool. I mean, to be honest, I would just promote something because they've given me something for free. That's how easily bought I am. However, these are genuinely really nice. The quality is excellent. I like the style. And yeah, go and have a look and see what you think.
You don't have to get a tie-dye one. I've gone for a classic plain white tee with, what is it? It's a stroll down Tottenham High Road, which celebrates some of the best pubs and takeaway places on the high road to kind of journey up towards the stadium. And that is a long sleeve white one. So, you don't have to go tie-dye. You can go classic.
You don't have to, but you should.
The brand name, Pleaties, is after David Pleat as well, which I liked, who incidentally recommended Eberechi Eze to Spurs, who's just joined Crystal Palace and who I really liked. And Pleaties is spelt Pleates. So do have a look, see what you think. How you doing, boys? You good?
Not bad. A little worn out with the old sitting in front of a screen with my microphone on over the last couple of days, but I'm coping.
It's been full on. It has been full on. I really, really enjoyed the Amazon documentary drop, watching 3 episodes. And I really enjoyed chatting to you guys about it. It was a lot of fun. It really took it out of me. And then Nathan, bless you, you had to then go and produce all 3 of those episodes. I don't know how you did it. So it was a lot of work. But I think worthwhile. I think it was worthwhile.
After watching 3 episodes, recording 3 episodes and editing 3 episodes, I was just sort of, Just taking a bit of time, hanging out this afternoon, and I flicked through my podcast app of choice. I thought, oh, look, there's a new Fighting Cock out. And I listened to the first 5 minutes, and I realised this, look, as much as I enjoyed the Fighting Cock, I really don't want to be thinking about All or Nothing for the next 40 minutes again. So I'm going to skip that one, I reckon.
The podcasts we put out have had largely a good reaction. I would say a mixed reaction. I got accused of having an anti-Mourinho agenda, which, to be fair, if you only listen to the first episode, that's probably probably fair. I mean, perhaps I should have done a better job at concealing my distaste for some of his comments. But I mean, I did say that there were certain parts of his talks with players that impressed me and I thought were good, and I really liked his interaction with the admin team in Lillywhite House. I thought that was lovely. Overall, I'm very excited about the Amazon show. I think it's been a lot of fun. There's been a lot of memes that come from it. Bardi, how did you find the experience of the day?
I quite enjoyed it. I mean, my wife wants to watch it now, but I don't know if I can bring myself to watch it because I've watched nearly each episode twice already and then spoken about it and then listened to various other podcasts talking about it. So I don't know. I'll maybe give it a little bit of time before I watch it again. But I enjoyed talking about it. I think if you haven't downloaded it, go and download it. It's nice.
Yeah, cool. So last time we spoke, Spurs have made another signing. Did I say that right? Since last time we spoke, Spurs have made another signing. Matt Doherty from Wolves. Very cheap. Good price point for what he is. Wrong side of 28, Nathan?
Wrong side of like 26, as far as I'm concerned. Very, very cheap fee. Like a really bad fee from Wolves' perspective, which brings up questions about Jorge Mendes. Is it Jorge Mendes? Oh God, we're getting into Jose territory
Mendes.
Again.
Jesus Christ, Mendes. Nathan, don't do this to us.
Which brings up some interesting questions about Mendes. It's maybe some slight concern there, but I guess there's also an extent to which that might be just how much players cost at the moment based on the pandemic and everything, and Wolves getting whatever they can for a player who's turning 28. Yeah. So I think that he is, you know, a good player, maybe a bit specified for perhaps what I thought we should be looking for, but a good player nonetheless. There have been questions raised by others about his defensive ability. I'm not so concerned about that from what I've seen. I think I'm going to do a second Doherty video, maybe. We'll see how that goes. The thing with both this transfer and the Højbjerg one is, like, yes, these are Premier League proven, experienced players, which is upside and downside. The normal downside of buying peak age Premier League players is they're really expensive, which is obviously something that we've overcome here. But it does also mean that, like, what's their resale value going to be like in 3 years' time? What's their quality of actual player going to be like in 3 years' time? It feels very much like we're buying players for now. And certainly there's the upside of, like, yeah, they're going to come in, they're going to have an immediate impact, they're going to be first team players, and that's something that obviously we desperately need. But it feels very in the manager's design, which is obviously a good thing. You want that sort of that positive connection between what the manager is seeking and what the club are actually offering in terms of players, and it's good to have that consistency. It's just that that particular design is like win the FA Cup, probably get top four, and then not be in such a good state with the squad in 3 years. But I don't think that's the end of the world. I think that we're not so poor that we can't afford to buy players for now and then have to reinvest in 2 or 3 years' time. That's not the absolute death for us. So maybe that's just to balance our squad needs, is a couple of players for now who are decent and will hold things down and have an immediate impact.
I did wonder about the price. I thought perhaps, is it partly a matter of perception and also what's gone before? So Wolves signed him really cheaply to begin with. So essentially they're flipping him for a huge, huge profit. And therefore, does it mean that they care slightly less about the price they're receiving for him? Is there something in that? So, for example, if they'd say paid 10 million for him all those years ago, would they be demanding a higher price? And is there something in the fact that they paid less, so maybe don't feel the need to kind of eke out as much as they can value-wise from a transfer? I don't know. It's just something that I wondered about, because it is absurdly cheap, even for this market, for a proven Premier League player who's, you know, I think we can say in his peak. He might be slightly over his peak, but he's roughly in his peak. Even with the Mendes link, it's, yeah, I don't know. It seemed cheap to me. What do you think of this, Bardi?
I quite like the idea. If we're going to persist with this kind of punch him with the right hand side, then I think he's a good wing back to do that. He reminds me very much of like Marcus Alonso. I think he pulls up similar kind of goals and assist ratio, where he's just useful and he's big and he's very tall, which kind of suits the Mourinho kind of profile. And I think it's a huge step up. I think Billy T put his kind of slant on stats and said 100% not Aurier, 100% not Aurier in all areas. So I think it's an improvement that way, and it's marginal gains. You know, we've been lacking certain areas, and it's perhaps not a groundbreaking transfer, but it improves it. I said it's like getting socks for Christmas. It's very useful and it's what you need. It's not kind of what you want, but I think it's a sensible signing. The price is great, and if you look across Wolves social media, they're kind of upset about it. They think they could have got double that money, and I think it will prove to be a quite astute signing. You could play the back four as an advanced right back. We can switch to a back three as well, and perhaps try Sessegnon in a left wing back role.
I've just searched down and retweeted that tweet you mentioned because I missed it before. So thanks for that. I do think the idea that like he only cost Wolves tens of thousands and therefore they're making a huge return there is sort of a variety of sunk cost fallacy. And I suspect Wolves, I don't think that's a useful way of thinking. I suspect Wolves are probably too smart for that. I don't think that's it. I think there's either something dodgy or suspicious at play here.
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea have shown, if you look at what the Swiss Ramble did on Chelsea's finances, Chelsea have been very clever on how they've sold players, when they've sold players, book value and the rest of it. So there could be that will go down into their books as a massive chunk of profit. So there are a lot of teams doing that. You saw Barcelona and Juve when they swapped Pjanic and Arta, that was pretty much all bookkeeping. Yep. And I think we might see a lot of that. I think FFP, if it even exists, won't count this kind of COVID period. But it's an opportunity for a lot of teams to do some smart accounting right now.
It reminded me of Football Manager, where you have a conversation with a player who wants to leave, and they say, "What transfer fee will you accept for me?" And you have to sort of make a judgment call as to how much you're willing to accept, and then keep that promise. Maybe Wolves have said to Doherty over some time, you know, we're willing to sell you if we hit a certain price. He's pushed them on it and they've said, right, this is the price. I don't know.
I mean, Arsenal are looking at, what, 20 million for Maitland-Niles, I think, who's got potential and everything, but he's still a kid, very unproven. I think this might turn out to be a very good signing. If not, it would just turn out to be a pretty decent one, which is kind of what we need at right back at the moment.
Well, as I tweeted, the key thing is it's a huge upgrade on Aurier. I know Aurier has a lot of fans, particularly on Reddit. A lot of fans do think Aurier is a good right back. I do not. I think he is a bad right back. I think Matt Doherty is going to be a big, big, big improvement, and I think we'll notice that from week one, basically. Interestingly, Newman on Twitter says, now that Mourinho is signing players, is it more evident that Poch was the problem with the lack of signings in the past two seasons? Was he being too picky? Nathan, what do you think? Do you think there's something in that?
Yeah, maybe. And this is kind of what I was saying before, with like we're getting Mourinho type players, and there's positives in that Mourinho is very clear. He wants, you know, PK's ready players. He doesn't need absolute superstars to play defence midfielder and right back. He needs functional players who will enable, hopefully, likes of, you know, Kane, Dele already in the squad to do special things, whereas Poch, you know, maybe is holding out for, you know, the likes of Lo Celso and Ndombele. I think a squad needs probably a balance of those kind of transfers. So yeah, no, fair enough. I don't think that's an unreasonable suspicion to have about the time under Poch team.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of reasonable to be picky when you are desperate to create exactly the right environment with exactly the right players who are able to do very specific tasks. But there comes a point where you've just got to look for better than what you've currently got. And I think that's what we've done this summer. You know, Højbjerg, Hart and now Doherty are not necessarily top four shoo-ins. They're not players that would trouble City or Liverpool's teams, but they're all better than the equivalent player that they've replaced. And that can be just as important in some ways. And I think with Doughty as well, we need to see that we've just sold Walker Peters for 13 million. So that makes it seem even cheaper in some ways. Although, of course, I do believe that Walker Peters will be a loss because that's me. Okay, Kartik Kyra says, now that we have a tall team like Mourinho wanted, do you think we'll see more goals from set pieces or do we definitely need a set piece coach? What do you think, Bardi?
I'm not sure if this will improve our chances at set pieces. I don't think if you can equate height with that. But what I think it does offer us is a diagonal option where we're further into the opposition half and then we can hit a diagonal at Doherty coming around the back post. We've seen that a few times with him playing for Wolves. We see, I mentioned Alonso already. Alonso does that quite a lot as well, especially against Spurs, where you have a taller fullback hitting that back post area. I think it might work for us there. I don't know if it's going to improve our goals from corners, but it might help us in defensive situations as well.
Nathan, how keen are you on us getting a set piece specialist to come in and coach the team?
Massively.
And I think have we got time for that though?
Yeah. You do an hour training session once a week. It's not game specific. You maybe can get towards doing game specific set pieces, but if you say, here are our three rotating attacking set piece routines, an outswinger, an inswinger, and a non-corner. Mm. That does so much for you. Maybe defensive set pieces need to be more specific, but I think that when you're starting from a generalized approach, that is, we'll have one guy on the near post 6 yard box, one player in the far post, and everyone else man marks, the bar is a pretty low point. I actually do think that's improving the overall height of the squads by a significant sort of boost to the average will see us be better defensively and attacking from set pieces. But it also says to me that we are then still going to massively underutilize that height advantage that we might have. And that just for me says even more reason to invest in the height that we have and utilize that better from attacking and defensive set pieces. I also think that we will punt the ball on from the keeper to Doherty a lot in Wolves style.
Yeah, I think we saw in the World Cup where England were able to make great success of just practicing set pieces. It does seem to happen a lot more in international football where you don't have the time with the players, but set pieces is definitely a way to eke out 7 or 8 extra goals a season for sure.
Definitely. And I agree about Doherty being a strength on diagonals, by the way. I think that's definitely going to be useful. I'm intrigued to see how he fits in stylistically, because unlike Aurier, who would hug the touchline and play high up, Doherty hugs the touchline but then makes a burst to the post. That's his style. He likes to attack the corner of the box. And in our current structure, it's more left to the attacking midfielder playing just inside him to attack the corner of the box. So I'm intrigued to see how we work that one out. It's going to take a little bit of work and a bit of getting used to.
If you had to guess, do you think that we will switch to a wide right winger with Doherty attacking inside the box? Or do you think we will ask Doherty to play differently and be a more of an outside attacker with the wide crossing game?
I think the latter.
Okay.
I think we'll ask Doherty to do the things that Aurier did, hug the touchline, put crosses in.
And occasionally get into the box. He's had a couple of shots, hasn't he? Mm. A couple of goals even.
Yeah. I do think that's what we'll start with. I don't think you're getting the best out of Doherty. If that's the approach, you're not going to get the goals, which have been really vital. And to be honest, we don't score many goals from defenders. It's always useful to have other positions chipping in, you know, especially against the stubborn defence, which we've at times struggled to break down. Having another goal scorer would be really, really helpful. I mean, we'll see. He might kind of just go against instruction and go with his instincts anyway, which is going to be to attack the back post. And if Lucas continues on that side, which I expect he will certainly initially, because Mourinho absolutely loves Lucas, he's pretty good at tracking back. So that would possibly work, but it definitely needs some tinkering with to get the best out of that side of the pitch. Greg Jenner says, assuming we ship out Carter Vickers and Foyt, that leaves us Dyer, Alderweireld, Sanchez and Tanganga as centre-back options on long contracts. So, would Skriniar or Kim Min-jae be an unnecessary investment when a striker and potential Ndombele replacement are needed? What do we think on that, Nathan? Do you think we've got enough at centre-back? I mean, you could probably add in Ben Davis into the mix as someone who could potentially cover centre-back as he did in one of the friendlies, as he has done for Wales. Is that enough?
I mean, essentially, I think you want, especially with this season coming up, you want four centre-backs you can trust to, if necessary, play a string of games. And so it comes down to, do you think Tanganga is a first or is a squad-level capable centre-back? You probably do. I don't, and that is why I think we probably want to make him fifth choice, which I think is fine for a young centre-back. There's still going to be some minutes there again with such a season as we have coming up, and especially if he can play in full-back positions here and there when necessary. But I think we want a fourth centre-back. We want to make Sanchez maybe fourth choice and have a younger... Because obviously Advero's getting on and maybe bring in a younger centre-back, the likes of Kim Min-jae. Who are eventually going to be a first choice centre half?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a short blog article looking at the early season fixture congestion that we're going to be facing. And basically, what I tried to do in that article was a bit of a proof concept of how we could rotate the team so that two players don't play consecutive matches because they're literally going to be playing two games in like 48 hours a few times, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on recovery. And we can do it if we've got an extra centre-back. So I included Carter Vickers and I included Foyth in my calculations. Now, if what Greg says is right and those two are gone, and I think we probably will sell one of them and maybe both of them, I tend to agree with Nathan that we're going to need at least one more centre-back to sort of get through that congestion. And if we stay in the Europa League, that congestion is going to carry on into the season. What do you think, Bardi? What are your priorities?
I mean, I don't know if Kim Min-jae is that kind of guy, whether he's proven enough and whether Mourinho has got the time and the patience to kind of bleed him in those kind of... blood him in those games. Skriniar is an interesting one. I think he's definitely available because Inter have kind of gone with their other three, and the young Italian chap Bastoni has been playing really well. So Skriniar is definitely available, but I just think he's a bit overpriced for someone who's not kind of first choice. I think he'd be a great signing, but I think he'd be too expensive for us. But with Dyer, Alderweireld, Sanchez, Tanganga, I wouldn't be too happy going. I wouldn't be upset starting the season with those four. I've kind of come around to keeping Foyth now, perhaps, and going with those five. I think if Ndombele leaves, I think our priority is sorting out that midfield. I reckon we can kind of scrape by with those four centre backs, and if we keep Foyth or Vickers, Carter Vickers, I think we need a striker replacement and a defensive midfielder. They are priorities.
All right, I'd be very happy to keep Foyth and him make up the fifth option. I don't think Carter Vickers should in any way be in consideration for playing for Spurs.
But he did have a decent season last year, didn't he, in the Championship? So, and I think he even counts as homegrown because he's been with us since he was like 10. I don't know. But yeah, whereas Foyth doesn't.
That is true. And with the number of non-homegrown players now, it's kind of at the one in, one out time. You know, we've got 17, so we're going to have to sell one or not name them in the squad at this point. So that's why I suspect we're now waiting for probably Aurier to leave before we announce our next signing or sign, you know, move on our next signing, as it were. We had lots of questions. I mean, you just mentioned Ndombele there, Bardi. We had lots of questions about Ndombele, from what's his problem to is he done? Nick Becker says, if we sell Ndombele for what we paid for him, what players could we buy that would fit with Jose's system that would make his loss more tolerable? Nathan, is the loss of Ndombele going to be tolerable in any way?
No.
So we should just persist with Ndombele, right?
It's very easy for me to sit here and say, hey, I watched all of these Ndombele games when he was in Ligue 1 and he's incredible. And we've got to find a way to get him into the team. If I'm not there at training and he's just like, you know, telling the manager to fuck off and never trying at all. I don't know how bad, you know, if he's cramming entire bags of Haribo into his mouth and never completes an entire sprint. If things are completely beyond possible with him, then we have to try and recoup some value. But my personal patience for him and my personal barrier for tolerance for the issues he's had so far is really high, because he's just such an incredible player. And I'd really like us to do whatever we can to try to make it work out with him.
But if we did sell him, who's top of your list?
I don't know. Sangare is top of my list to come in and take that role from him and be a more defensive version of Ndombele, I guess.
Buddy, Andrew Felder says, is sell Tongi and use the funds to buy Grealish at all realistic?
I mean, I don't see why not. It'd be crazy to sign Grealish for a huge amount after we've had the opportunity to sign him a couple of seasons ago for quite cheap. I personally think Ndombele's done at Spurs, which is a huge, huge shame. I think the only thing that can save Ndombele is if something bad happens to Mourinho in the next couple of weeks. I'd be well up for selling him and then buying Grealish. I don't think that's a bad turnaround, and it's probably well within our budget that could happen if we get a decent amount for Ndombele.
I think that sort of stylistically might give us a bit of a gap. Obviously there's sort of a general coverage throughout the team there, but they're definitely not like for like players. Grealish is more similar to Lo Celso in that, yeah, he can play deep, but I think generally you prefer to have him as the most attacking of three midfielders or one of the attacking band. Southgate came out the other day and said pretty much straight up, I will never play this man in midfield. He will always be an attacker or a winger to me, which is bold. I don't see why he couldn't be, again, a really attacking number eight. But Ndombele for me is a much deeper player than that, a ball progressor, someone who can pick up the ball from deep. Contrary to maybe what we've seen, someone who puts up quite impressive defensive numbers and is a controlling player, whereas Grealish is a creative attacking player like Lo Celso.
But could Grealish, the way he plays at the moment, be a matter of circumstances with Villa, that he's their best player, so they kind of need him to get as near to the box as possible, whereas with Spurs we can kind of afford to keep him further away from the box because we have those kind of individuals there. Kind of like in the same way, maybe perhaps that Betis use Lo Celso, and we could maybe benefit with Grealish's dribbling and his ability to draw fouls and perhaps beat the press in a deeper role. I think he's young enough to maybe try that role.
Yeah,
I'd quite like to see it.
Maybe. I think that's a good shout, actually.
Grealish is ridiculously good, and he's very much Premier League proven.
Yeah,
I think Grealish goes to a club and improves them, to be honest.
He's
young.
Player. He's English. He's young,
and he's now English.
He fits the Vardy criteria.
It ticks all my boxes.
So the other thing that's changed since we last recorded a podcast is the boardroom. So this was confusing, right? We've appointed Trevor Birch. So Trevor Birch is someone who... I mean, he's not a famous name, I wouldn't say, but he's been at a lot of big clubs and seems to have performed key roles at some of them. And the initial sort of announcement of Trevor Birch led everyone to say, oh, wow, we've got our director of football.
Yeah.
It turns out that we already had a director of football, sort of, and Birch is not performing that role. So what we understand is that Trevor Birch has come in... Where are we? What's his role? Director of Football Operations,
yeah,
which is overseeing the what's happening on the training ground, whatever that means. he's making sure that everything is in place for the club to be sustainable from youth to seniors. It's quite opaque, I think. What this incoming role holder means is there's been a shake-up of existing roles. So Rebecca Capelhorn has taken on a new role, and Steve Hitchin has taken on a new role. Steve Hitchin is doing what we see more as a traditional director of football, I think, heading up the sort of recruitment side and the analyst, I guess. What we know from this as well, from an article written by Dan Kilpatrick, is that Hitchin is going to form part of the new committee with Jose Mourinho and with Daniel Levy. So that's our recruitment committee now. I don't think there's any change there. I think already there were, you know, Mourinho and Hitchin and Levy would have worked closely together. This perhaps formalises that. Any thoughts, Nathan?
this the possible positive is that this somehow forms a means by which this is something of a promotion for Hitchin, and there's more power in his department. I don't have a huge amount of information about Hitchin. Obviously, our transfers during his return to Spurs have been very mixed. But just that he is a specialist in this area, and he's not the manager, and he's not Daniel Levy, and therefore he's a man who is directing football, you know. Damien Comolli likes him, or seemed to like him, brought him with him to Liverpool. I've got a lot of time for Comolli. So that's about the only read I have on Hitchin. But nonetheless, just with the general circumstances, I'm hoping this means that the changing around and dereliction of duties means that Hitchin has more power.
I like the idea of Daniel Levy being further removed from what's happening on the ground. I think it's really important that we have a team of absolute specialists in their respective areas who lead the different departments, and it is departments now. Where, you know, this is a seriously big club. They have significant staff working beneath them to deliver on these things. And Daniel Levy at times has been accused of trying to do too much, trying to be too involved. We've seen that some of his kind of football decisions have been perhaps his downfall in the past. I see this as a very good thing. He's got a board of people who are all seen as highly successful in their fields, who will enable him to hopefully have better oversight of the club in general, rather than, you know, meddling in matters that are below his pay grade. So I guess we watch and we wait and we see what happens. The interesting thing about Birch is that he doesn't tend to stay at clubs too long. He's moved around a lot. Lots of people are making assumptions about the fact that we could be lining up a sale of the club. I think it's too early. I think it's too early for that. I don't think Levy's in a position where he could sell at this point. There needs to be more value added to the club. We've got this huge stadium debt. I mean, it's not a debt as such. Well, it is a debt, but it's like having a mortgage, essentially. It's a debt we can manage. But I think for him to get absolute maximum value, if he is to ever sell, and he will sell eventually, but if he's to look towards a sale, I think he needs to wait a little longer. So I wouldn't necessarily buy into that theory, although I appreciate where it's come from, because previously Birch has been at a club and then they've been sold, and then he's been at another club and they've been sold. So there's some logic being applied there. Nathan?
But yes, that has happened to him a handful of times. Well, that's been his role a handful of times, but he does also have like a full lengthy career being like a football finance guy for decades at you know, high level clubs. So he's not just a guy who facilitates sales. I have a something of a Swansea contact who had some at least reasonable regard for Birch as like a smart guy. That is the beginning and end of my insight to Birch.
So, I mean, the idea is that he comes in and he oversees the day-to-day running of Hotspur Way, right? And on the surface, that sounds like a very overblown role for overseeing the training ground. But then you think about it, and there is so much going on at that training ground. You know, you think we've got teams from, I don't know, under eights up to the first team. You've got all the physios, you've got the commercial activities, you've got the sort of team, the player hotel there. That's a lot to manage, and it kind of makes sense that someone would be kind of a head of department of that in terms of coaching, in terms of everything, you know, overall responsibility for everything. So I think it kind of makes sense. Bardi, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I think removing some of the responsibility from Daniel Levy is always good. We see more kind of big companies turn into like a chief of operations who look after the kind of the real kind of stuff happening at the club or the company. Mm. Levy chairing the football board is an interesting use of terms. I think he will be there to listen, hopefully, to his advisors and not perhaps make the decisions himself. Allow that to be a group decision. And the other thing was the first team recruitment and sales led by Hitchin, Mourinho and Levy is probably a good thing. If selling players has always been perhaps a bigger problem than buying players. Mm. So I think anything that helps us sell better is a good thing.
So I didn't mention what Rebecca Capelhorn would now be doing. She's going to be the Director of Football Administration and Governance. And I presume that means she oversees the activities going on in Lillywhite House that we saw in the documentary. So the HR, the finance, etc., etc., which again, you know, you need a leadership figure there, so that makes complete sense. There's a lot of governance to adhere to in football now. There's financial fair play. There's UEFA regulations. So, yeah, all for that. Fine. As you can tell, we don't really know a lot about this. We don't really know what to expect from it. We kind of had assumptions on how the club was run beforehand. It's all very opaque. So we're just going on what our trusted beat journalists can tell us about this. And I guess it remains to be seen. I guess, yeah, watch this space. So the other things left to talk about are the friendly games against Reading and against Birmingham. We beat Reading 4-1. We beat Birmingham 1-0. The Reading game I quite enjoyed. The Birmingham game, less so. Any thoughts, Bardi, from either of those matches?
I didn't watch the Reading game, and I tuned in for the Birmingham game to watch Harry Kane, who they just left on the bench and sucked me in. Signing up for that, I got the free passes, and signing up for the free pass was nearly as painful as watching the football match. And then I didn't even see Kane's face, so I was left really disappointed. But it was a beautiful goal from Bergy, who swept it into that bottom corner. He likes that. He likes that little part of the net.
He looked great when he came on. He was the best player, I thought, against Birmingham. As he always is, he's very skillful and very tidy. Nathan, what did you think of these two matches?
I didn't sign up for the N17 pass. I'm an idiot, and so is my father. We both received emails saying, sign up now for your free pass, and then paid it no attention and thought, yeah, I'll do it on the day, and then that's too late. Apparently, you need to have signed up in advance, and then only on the day you have to pay, and I'm not going to pay for something that I should have had for free. So I'm having to illegally stream these pre-season matches, which is quite a challenge, it turns out. There's not a huge amount of coverage of, you know, a Spurs-Birmingham friendly on a Saturday afternoon when, like, there's actual competitive football going on. So it's been a slightly challenging experience on the technological end, we've pressed high at times. That's nice to see. Especially what's really interesting, someone pointed this out on Twitter, I can't remember who, I apologize, someone pointed out just how much people on the documentary use the word pressing, talk about pressing, press them hard, press them early.
Yep.
And then you think about the actual football, and a lot of the time we've been in a medium or even a low block, maybe more of a low block towards the other end of the documentary, and we'll see how that sort of works out, but it's amusing. Anyway, we've been pressing high, and we've been pressing high in patches, and we turn the ball over a few times, and that's interesting, you know, it's interesting to see.
Shout out to N17 TV as well for a crisp and pretty fresh stream as well.
Great.
It was pretty nice for something that Spurs put together. It was pretty good.
Yeah, it really was. The streaming quality was excellent. Yeah. And also, it's headed up by friend of the pod, Ben Haynes, who is doing a smashing job of fronting Spurs's streaming delivery. He's had some ex-Spurs players there to interview. It's lovely to have someone like Ben, who we know is a knowledgeable, genuine fan, fronting up our delivery. It's great.
Ben, sort us out with a pass, please, mate.
I don't think the last game's due to be streamed.
Oh, for God's sake.
You might have to put up with nothing, Nathan, for the Watford match. I don't think there's much more to talk about from these games. There's so many subs that they're kind of tend to lose a lot of meaning. One thing that's noteworthy is that Jedson started as a 10. He was absolutely horrible as a 10. He didn't do anything right. He moved deeper into midfield and looked a lot better.
I thought Joe Hart has a magnificent voice on him. He absolutely, his voice booms out. I know you can hear a lot of stuff with no fans there anyway, but he was properly going after his defence at corners. Rather than like Lloris, you hear the away at corners, but Joe Hart was absolutely screaming at them, and he kept telling Dyer. It reminded me of I used to watch that TV show, you know, where the farmers get all the sheep into the little pens, and you hear them shouting at their dog to control the sheep. He was shouting at Dyer, "Organize them, Eric!" And it was quite nice to hear. And I do like a very vocal goalkeeper. It normally gets drowned out, but it was nice to hear. Winner, that's what you get. He's a winner organizer.
He's literally got Premier League contracts off the back of being loud at this stage of his career, yeah. I reckon.
Yep.
I thought Jedson wasn't as bad at right back as was perceived on Twitter, but still not great. So
I think Jedson's fine at right back. I think he's not a 10. I don't want to see him play 10. I mean, I get why he would play 10 because he's got legs and he really can run. He's incredibly, incredibly athletic and has amazing stamina. So the logic is there, but I don't think his touch is good enough to play 10. I don't think his anticipation is good enough. I don't think his awareness is good enough. He's much more suited to having the pitch in front of him rather than having his back to goal.
Well, I don't even know if it's that, because I just think his inability to turn. He's all right once he's going somewhere, but there's zero subtlety. Even when the ball was being cleared and he was collecting it and he ended up facing his back four, he's just, even though he had so much space, he was just unable to quickly turn and go the other way. He was always laying it backwards. It just doesn't seem to have a reverse gear in him.
You are describing a fullback.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe he will end up being a £50 million right back that we end up having to... Imagine there's like an injury crisis, and if he plays one more minute, we have to buy him, and Mourinho needs to make a decision, put a substitute on, and he just decides to put a goalkeeper on at right back because he doesn't want to give minutes to Jedson, doesn't want to buy him.
If we activate that transfer fee for Jedson, I'm going to find another club to support because there's no logic there at all. The transfer fee, the agreed transfer fee, is only there, I'm sure, to encourage a future sale for a high value to another club. So they can say, look, we valued him at 50 million at one point. He's not worth 50 million. He's barely worth 5 million. He's a young player who's got some potential. We've got lots of those already. It's odd. It's very odd. Mm. When I watched him play as a 10, I was like fully on board with Nathan's terminate his loan contract take from a previous podcast. So, yeah. Sanjeev Kumar says, given the crazy fixture list, do fringe players and youth prospects have a big role to play in our progression in cups and the league? So, Bardi, we've seen Dennis Sirkin perform well. We've seen Harvey White look tidy in midfield. We've seen Sessegnon on the left. We've seen Clark on the right. We've even seen Jamie Bowden come off the bench and Alfie Devine, Dane Scarlett. We've seen Cameron Carter-Vickers come in at centre-back. Do you think we're going to need these players in the early stages of the season?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if I don't know how keen we will be to take Kane, Delhi, and the rest of them to Lokomotiv Plovdiv. Yeah, I think that will be a team of backup players and youth guys that go there.
How about you, Nathan? Do we need to integrate some of these players in the early stages?
We really need to. And I tweeted this before, but I think that we should fully hand over the League Cup to our youth staff, by which I mean Mourinho doesn't think about it. Mm-hmm. None of our first team players lose any training time to that competition, at least until the later rounds, at least until 2021. Because I just think we have to drop a competition. And I like the way that we normally do that is like, okay, yeah, the manager picks youth players, but he's still dedicating training time, dedicating mental capacity, you know, one or two senior players. And what I'm saying is, you know, like the way the EFL trophy is handed for Premier League sides, and I appreciate that lower league sides are upset with that, but I think as a club, we have to approach it in that manner and say, this is not our competition yet.
Yeah, I agree. I'm fully on board with that. And I think the early stages of the Europa League as well, I think they are set up perfectly for some of our young players to be involved. Certainly White and Sirkin, who, for my money, are ready for some minutes. I'm not saying start them against Man U in the league. I'm saying let's give them 60 minutes or even half an hour in the Europa League and see what happens. Sirkin's going to be a fantastic rotation at left back, and White is a very capable central midfielder. Doz says, please try and explain how Spurs have managed to end up with one recognised striker without using the tried and tested excuse that football has changed and everyone plays inverted wingers now. So how have we ended up in this predicament, Bardi, where we only have one out-and-out striker?
I think because we just keep buying bad strikers. I think if Vincent Janssen, we tried with Vincent Janssen to sign a striker. We had Llorente for a bit. And then since then, we just haven't been able to, for some reason, to find a striker that fits maybe the age profile, the experience profile. Mourinho wasn't keen on using a youngster in Troy Parrott. So I think we did try, but it's got to that place now where we do need to buy a striker. But I think we have tried in the past.
Any thoughts, Nathan?
I mean, yeah, we sort of said it before, and we have used the Trident Test excuse about using wingers in that role and everything. We've talked before about the way that Kane is sort of a vacuum for all minutes, that he's only going to lose out minutes to a genuinely capable forward. I really liked the Vincent Janssen signing at the time. I thought he looked really good in Eredivisie. I think a lot of players look good in Eredivisie, maybe. Mm. I don't know. I guess it's hard. I certainly hope that we are prepared to invest some money in that role this summer because Parrott is out on loan, and Kane won't give way to playing Son or Lucas or Dele in that role. I think.
I think Son is genuinely a really good striker. I think he's really good when he plays up top, but he's also our best attacking midfield player. So you lose something if you sort of rotate Kane out and you put Son up front. It's like, well, now we've got Bergwijn and Lucas. I like Bergwijn, less keen on Lucas, but that's not as strong a line behind the striker. And like you say, it's not a natural backup to Kane, and Kane simply will demand the minutes if there's no like obvious replacement for him. I think it's partly a psychological thing with Kane. It's essential. It's really essential that we sign a striker this summer. It's been essential before, but it's got even more essential now with the number of games this season. Unless we go out of the Europa League really early, which is, of course, a possibility. Final question. This is from Ray Guildford. He asked us to discuss the possibility of signing an attacking left wing back to complement Doherty. We could then revert to a back three. Dyer and Toby suit this, in Ray's opinion. And he talks about the possibility of selling Ndombele and buying another midfielder as well. What do you think? I mean, we've not seen Mourinho play much sort of wing backs yet. When he's played a back three, it's been one of the fullbacks tucking round. But do we see this as a possibility, Nathan, with Matt Doherty and Ryan Sessegnon? Maybe,
yeah, Ryan Sessegnon. We have an attacking left wing back. His name is Ryan Sessegnon. I think that, like, okay, maybe now what we want to do is sell Aurier and buy a second choice right back who is perhaps more of the defensive build, so that we have an attacking option and a defensive option on both sides, and we get sort of a full coverage there. And you can play one of one or two of both or three centre backs behind them and the two attacking ones, etc. And you have that kind of coverage. I really don't want us to go out and buy an attacking left back because we have that in Sessegnon, and I really want to see him get some minutes as and when we are using that role. And I hope that we find space for that role this season.
It's good, though, that Doherty gives us the opportunity to play wing-backs if needed. We know he's very capable at wing-back. That's a thing, so it gives us some flexibility. And, Bardi, I'm interested in what you think of this idea that Dyer and Alvarado are suited to playing as part of a back three.
I mean, under Pochettino's kind of best run of form at Spurs, we played a back three with Dyer, Toby and Yang, so I think that works. I like Dyer in a back three. I think Dyer as a centre midfielder is probably finished now. I'm less sold on Sessegnon. I'm going to keep my opinions to myself for a little while, but I'm starting to have doubts. I'm starting to have doubts about Sessegnon. I'm not going to say bin him off, but I'm just a little bit concerned that we're still using that he lacks confidence thing. I will wait before I pass judgment on him. But I'm having doubts anyway.
Buddy, judging by my Twitter mentions, you are very much not alone in that. Sessegnon is not popular amongst our fan base.
So I'm now like one of those people that troll you.
I've always thought of you as a troll.
Okay.
And we shall leave it there. Until next time. You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.